Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Thank you for joining me for this bonus episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is one of my favourite people in the whole world. And it's Christine Davis, aka My Auntie Chris. I've actually mentioned her on the podcast before. She's my mother's youngest sister. And we've always been close, me and Chris, and it was always my plan to get her on this podcast. And one of those reasons is because of her job. So Chris is a nurse, and for the last few years, she's been working as an occupational health nurse in a big local factory where there's hundreds, I think 500 is the amount, 500 men pretty much work in this factory. And we all know that mental health in men at the moment is a ever-increasing problem, shall we say. And in Chrissy's role in occupational health, she sees a lot of it. You know, people have to come and speak to her, and you know, she has to kind of guide them in the right direction and try and look after them a little bit. And it's always kind of fascinated me, the idea of speaking to her, because she's right in the middle of this. She's working with everyday, ordinary, normal people that are going through these things, and in some cases she's their port of call, you know, so she's on the ground. So I just thought she'd be a fantastic person to chat to. And you know, you think of men's mental health, and just to look at some stats, I pulled up a page in front of me on Google on the laptop, and I mean, these stats are a little bit old, but they're kind of the most complete ones that I could find. But get on this, right? So just over 3 out of 4 suicides are by men, and suicide is the biggest cause of death for men under 35. And 12.5% of men in the UK are suffering from one of the common mental health disorders. Men are nearly 3 times more likely than women to become alcohol dependent. Men are more likely to use and die from illegal drugs. And men are less likely to access psychological therapies than women. So that kind of shows why male mental health is on the rise. But the question is why, right? So we need to understand why. We know the stats are bad, and we want to raise awareness and encourage people to talk, but we want to know why. Why are they so bad, and why are they moving in the wrong direction? And you know, people like Chris, who are, you know, on the ground getting their hands dirty, are the people that we need to be speaking to about this, because they have a unique insight. So that's the first reason I wanted to get Chris on. And the other reason is, well, she kind of featured quite prominently in my own mental health journey, really. And like I say, I mentioned her on a previous episode of the podcast. And I suppose I have said before that with mental health, when you've experienced something, or when you've got experience of something, you kind of get like a sixth sense for other people who have gone through it. And a couple of times over the years, when I was really struggling with my mental health and in quite a dark place at times, but I hadn't told anyone. I hadn't been to a doctor. I hadn't been diagnosed. I hadn't even really had an open conversation with my wife about what was going on. We just both knew that something wasn't right with me. And Chris kind of reached out to me really, really early on. She kind of spotted that something wasn't right. And we had a bit of a chat, and I felt a lot better for it. And that was maybe one of the first times I started thinking about making some changes and reaching out and getting a bit of help. And then fast forward to much more recently, to about 6-7 months ago, and off the back of quite a big spell, shall we say, and I was in a very, very dark place, and I had to go back to Wales for a couple of days, and I sat down with Chris, and again, she helped me a lot. We talked about some medication, and she gave me some information from her perspective as someone who's worked in nursing and in different aspects of nursing and worked in the NHS and all that sort of stuff. And I made some different decisions about what I was going to do with myself. And it worked out really, really well. And I'll always be very, very grateful. So I suppose a bit of context, really. Me and Chris have always been really close. She's only about like 13, 15 years older than me, something like that, even though she's my mum's younger sister. When I was a little kid, She was like the cool older auntie, and she used to sweep in and buy me wrestling stickers and sweets and stuff like that. And then when I was a grumpy teenager and getting really, really heavily into music, she'd give me vinyl and, you know, patches to sew on my denim jacket and all that sort of stuff. So we've always been close. And as we sort of like, just carried on through life, we've stayed close. And I think mental health has bonded us even more in recent years. And she's fantastic. And this is a fantastic chat. We sat down, we set the microphone up, and we just kind of got into it. And we chat about our own stories. We chat about her experiences in work and some of the ideas behind, and you know, how her process works and stuff like that. And it's a great, great listen. So I really appreciate your feedback on this one. If you want to give me a shout on social media at Proper Mental Podcast, on all the usual platforms. If you want to, the best way to learn a bit more about Chris is to hop on All Four and check out some previous episodes of Come Dine With Me, because that's where she made her fame back in the day. She'll be over the moon that I'm telling you about. So anyway, that's enough from me. Here we are with a bonus episode of the Proper Mental Podcast with the amazing Auntie Chris. Headphones and stuff like that, because on a computer you never know like what they're using or how it's going to come out.
No, I see it's so professional.
Yeah, it's got better as it's gone on. The first couple are a little bit cringy, but as it goes on, it gets better and better and better.
That's the same as everything, though. It's really curve, isn't it?
And once you have when I have other podcasters on, that's always good, because you know that they're going to have really good microphones and stuff like that.
But you could spend a lot of money on it, could you?
Yeah, thousands probably. Some people go to a studio and have a proper producer and stuff like that, but you know.
Yeah.
One day, maybe,
Something nice about having informal chats, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like a conversation then, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's not like you're gonna go to forced or anything.
Yeah. Before lockdown, I didn't used to like listening to podcasts that had been recorded on Zoom. I didn't like the quality, because you're so used to all the really posh ones. And then now, for the last year, all podcasts have been on Zoom.
Yeah, it's true.
And you just get used to the shitty quality, and it doesn't matter as much. So in a way, for podcasting,
it's good.
It's been really, really good. Yeah,
it's good.
So I'm recording now, Chris. And this is my first recording in person on my new portable equipment. Look at that. I know. Wow. First live. Yeah, how good's that?
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. So, for anyone listening, I am chatting today to Christine Davis, a.k.a. Auntie Chris.
Auntie Chris.
How are you, mate?
I'm good, my darling. How are you, Tom?
Yeah, good. I was trying to think before when the last time I saw you was in person. Was that about November or something? Maybe November, October, something like that.
When did you come down?
Yeah, about then, I think. And I think before that, it would have been last summer. So the kids haven't been down in a year anyway.
Yeah, it was a miserable afternoon, wasn't it? We went for a walk.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it was
grey and raining. And
Yeah. Before we get into it, I wanted to ask you about the vaccinations, Chris, because you've been, since they started rolling out in Wales, pretty much, you've been part of that rollout.
Oh, yeah, it's been amazing. I started on the 18th of December. And we hit the ground running, and we worked in a field hospital up in Swansea. Huge. They used to use it as television studios. So we hit the floor running, we had intensive training, and it was first, we used the Pfizer when it first came out, and it was just having this little pot of gold. It was so emotional, and it was such a privilege to be on board. And everybody had this, we were so nervous, and in the beginning it was surreal, because nobody knew, it was the first rollout.
Yeah.
And nobody knew, nobody ever had done it, and the policies were so new, and it was just amazing. So we've started, in December. And because I'm on a part-time basis, they more or less have trained all their own NHS staff now, because they sort of have seconded everybody and pulled in people who were on furlough and things like that. So they pulled nurses from everywhere. And I've worked with people, I've worked with dentists, pharmacists, people I would never, ever have come into contact, and it's just been fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, I wouldn't have met these people before, and they're, you know, firm friends now.
And you were doing really long days, eh? How many injections were you kind of giving?
Oh gosh, in the beginning, it all depends. In the beginning, it was a bit hit and miss, because we were doing it in January and we had the over 80s, and we had a lot of DNAs some days, you know, because they were elderly and they couldn't get there. But, you know, probably I would say about 1,500 a day.
Wow.
Yeah. But it was, you know, there was a lot of us vaccinating.
Yeah.
And of course, with the Pfizer, it's, you have to draw it up, so you have to put the saline into the vial. So it takes a lot of time to draw the actual vaccine up. So it's not a quick process.
Right.
The AstraZeneca is a bit faster, because it's pre-drawn
right.
in the solution.
Yeah.
So you can just pull that up. But the Pfizer took a bit of time, because you have to pre-mix it with the saline.
Yeah. And did you do that while you were on furlough, or did
no,
you do it?
I did it originally over Christmas when I was on annual leave. My boss was absolutely fantastic, and they were happy for me to do it. And then I've just done it then on a part-time basic, you know, ad hoc on weekends now and things. So
yeah.
I say, and it's quieting it down now. They've got all their NHS staff trained up, and people are in post now. So, you know, my days are numbered, really. You know,
yeah,
it's just covered in sickness and holidays now, so it's going to be quite rare.
Yeah.
But that's great.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
I only did it in the, you know, the interim. I didn't think I was going to be there as long as I was, but no, it's been fantastic,
yeah.
Gotta say.
And what is, if we can talk about your day job, your real job, because that's kind
job.
Of what we're going to be getting into today a little bit. So what is it that you do, Chris?
Well, I'm a qualified nurse. It's my background. And the last 5 years, I've been an occupational health advisor, and I work in a steelworks. And we make manufacture tin cans. Or manufacture tin plate, and it makes a tin can, so most people know us because we're the sole supplier for Heinz.
Oh, okay.
So we've been key workers during COVID pandemic, because we had to keep your tins going, really busy. Yeah
And it's am I right in thinking that it's predominantly men that work in your factory? Yeah,
I think at the last count, I think we had something like 20 women.
Wow.
And they're in there's nobody, I think we've got one engineer and a couple in technical, but most of them are admin staff or HR.
Yeah,
are the women's, but there's oh gosh, very, very few are actually involved in the process.
Yeah. So how many blokes work there roughly?
I would say on average about 500 employed by Tata, but we also do we've got core contractors, so they've got engineers and fitters and packers who are subcontracted through their agencies or through their companies, but they are core contractors, so I would say there's probably about 100 of them.
Yeah. And then as an occupational health nurse, what do you have to do? What is that?
Well, there's two components to my job. Big is legislative, because we deal with lots of, you know, you can imagine safety critical working, making sure people are safe to do what they're doing, you know, working at high confined spaces, driving plant and equipment, so they have to be tested regularly to make sure they're safe to do the job, really.
Yeah, tested in what sort of testing?
So to do a safety critical role,
right,
so say
okay.
to make sure that they they can work at height or confined spaces, or we're not putting them in any position where they shouldn't be.
Right, okay.
Or they could cause an accident. So that's the legislative bit. And we also do things like skin surveillance, asbestos surveillance, hand arm vibration, you know, all these legislative trainings. So that's half the job. And then the other half then is sickness absence, and making sure that people you know, are supported when they're off work, or if they need any help accessing counselling, or you know, or they need restrictions, or just manage them in the workplace, because obviously sometimes people are ill and they can't do their substantive post, so they might need to do something different. The big thing at the moment, we've got a couple of cases of long COVID.
Okay,
so that's very, very new, managing these people who are really, really being knocked out by COVID.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't do their own job and they need a lot of support coming back to work.
Wow, yeah.
And this is something we've never had to think about before.
Yeah, it's all new.
Yeah.
Yeah. And over the year, how long have you been there?
I've been there 2007, I started part-time.
Yeah.
So I started that just on weekends, and then the last 5 years then I went back to uni and did my Occult diploma, and I've been there full-time the last 5 years.
Wow. And over that time, have you seen a rise in people coming to you for mental health related stuff?
Definitely. Definitely. And particularly, I would say, the last couple of weeks since COVID, it's
right.
been huge.
Yeah.
Really, really huge. I think that the issue is, there's a lot more in the public domain now and people will talk about it, whereas before, men particularly, you know, didn't say anything. And how do you verbalise when you're feeling as low as you are?
Yeah, yeah, when you don't know what it is.
You know, right. And you say, hi, yeah, how are you? And, yeah, fine, thanks.
Yeah.
And you're feeling, you know, lower than in a curb some days. So
yeah.
how do you, you know, how do you verbalise that you're really not okay?
Yeah, so if people bring that to you, for a starter, if someone sits down with you and says, oh, I'm suffering with my mental health, what do you have to do then in your official capacity?
Well, obviously, because of the nature of mental health, we're mainly talking of anxiety or depression,
yeah,
which can
yeah.
be sort of on huge scales, isn't it? But mainly in occupation-wise, it's sort of mild to moderate. Probably doesn't feel it for the individual, but it's normally on mild to moderate. Obviously, you've got to take on board, you know, are these people suicidal? Do they need crisis intervention? Which I have had to do on a few occasions because people have been, you know, referred as a matter of urgency to me. But normally, it's mild to moderate depression that's been coming on for a while. But something, normally it's reactionary because something's happened. Relationship issues, financial issues, bereavement, sickness, all these type of things. So they're normally reacting to a period in their life where they're really struggling.
Yeah, yeah. Does that take a bit of digging then? Because if men don't like to talk and they can't always verbalise what's happening, and do they sort of come in to see you and you have to kind of read between the lines
yeah.
or try and...
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, because... same old stiff upper lip, I'm a man, I should be feeling like this. And because people don't talk, you know, women talk, women will tell you about everything, won't they? They're very open and honest and whatever. Men will talk about sport, cars, holidays, but they never actually talk about their feelings. That's something very, very alien to men.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know whether you have conversations with your mates about your feelings.
Some of them, yeah. It's one of the reasons why I thought this would be a really interesting episode, because I think depending on what your like your circles are and your support networks and stuff like that. So I'm quite open about my mental health,
yeah.
and I tend to knock about with people that are as well. So it's I can understand why blokes don't talk, but I also am a bloke that talks. So that's I'm removed from that, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm in heavy industry, people don't talk.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a different ball game. And I think as well, with that sort of like really blokey at work environment.
Absolutely.
It's very, very easy for people to distract themselves, right?
Yeah.
So it's all lots of laddie banter, it's all
yeah.
lads, pints on a Saturday, football, you know, line of coke, all this sort of
absolutely
you know, distraction things
yeah.
that in the short term makes you feel you forget, you know, that something's going on, and then you feel like shit, and it's like, oh, because I've just done a load of beak on Saturday. That
absolutely.
Is a come down, it's not depression.
Yes.
You know, so that I think that kind of
yeah.
it's very easy in that environment to distract until
yeah.
the wheels come off, right?
I totally agree with you, and I think the thing is, people do try and self-medicate for whatever, as you say, alcohol, food, gambling, whatever. They try and think, and they're all short-term fixes, and but the problem never goes away, and most of the time it makes it worse.
Yeah.
But no, I agree with you. This is it. I will do this to make myself better. And when you're feeling like that, you haven't got the clarity to actually understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And because you don't talk to anybody else about it, you know, a lot of people say to me, what, other people feel like I do? And I go, yeah, they do. And it's like a light bulb moment for them because it's sort of like, what? I'm not going off my head. I'm not mad. Other people feel like I do. And I'm going, honestly, you would be so surprised if you started having conversation with people who've actually been there.
Yeah, you could be like, you're my third one today.
Yeah. It's not even lunchtime. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And the good thing is, I can say to them, we'll get you back on track. Mm. We will get you back on track. Just work with me. Another issue, and perhaps I could ask you this, Tom, because you were very reluctant to go on antidepressants. Yeah. What was your barriers to going on them? Because I do get this all the time, because people, I don't take tablets, I'm addictive. I'm going to do this myself.
Yeah.
And you were very, very resistant to it.
Yeah. It took me about 2 years before I gave in and, and took some. And now I still take mine now. I'm a big not an advocate for them, because it is personal choice, but they work very well for me.
Yours worked very quickly as well, didn't it?
Yeah,
because
really
I texted you on the Friday, so I'd seen you on the Sunday, the Monday night, and I texted you on the Friday, have you been to the doctors? And you were like a different person.
Yeah, I was skipping, yeah.
It was very, very quick.
Yeah.
Very, very quick.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was like placebo, like I'd been desperate for help for so long, and I just felt like I was being seen and being listened to and had an actual physical thing, because I was doing a lot of things that were very where you just like put it into the universe and hope for the best, like meditation and yoga, and to actually have like a physical thing.
Would you agree? Yeah, definitely.
I still do them now. I always say mental health is like a puzzle, and you need like a little bit of everything, and
absolutely,
everyone's puzzle's different, right?
Yeah.
So for me, maybe it was just having that thing. It was a little bit of placebo. Maybe it just like kicked in quick. I don't know. I couldn't care less, to be honest. It worked.
Tom,
for me.
It was unbelievable. Because
it was
like, wow.
Yeah.
So why were you so reluctant to go on medication?
Loads of reasons, really. I think when you kind of, like, for a start, you hear a lot of horror stories. A lot of people say, like, it turned me into a zombie.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop eating. It took me, like,
and you,
10
there
years.
Are drugs.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
They
might not always be the right one for you.
Yeah, and people aren't lying about their experience. But
no.
I didn't realise that my experience could be different.
Positive.
Yeah, and when you don't really want to do something, you look for the anomaly.
Yeah.
So if someone might say to me, it took me 5 years to get off them, and I'd say, well, I can't take them. It took them 5 years to get off them.
Absolutely.
And then, but I wouldn't take advice from them over like looking after me kids or dietary advice or
so
why suddenly am I taking medical advice off them,
yeah.
right? But that's when you don't want to do something, you look for the anomaly, you look for the reason not to. So it was partly stuff like that. And then I used to say I was open about my mental health, but I wasn't really. I just told like a couple of people and went to counselling.
Yeah.
But I wasn't that open about it. And to sit down with a doctor and say, I think I have depression, was like I didn't want to have depression. I didn't want it so badly that I thought.
And you didn't want to say.
Yeah, I didn't want to say it, because once I'd said it, then I had it. You know,
yeah.
I didn't want to have it. I was hoping to just get past it on my own.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of being resistant to pills is that people just don't want to, because it just feels so final. It just feels like saying, right, I am in this mental health box. Here's my diagnosis. It's going to define me. And, you know, none of that is true. It doesn't define you at all. And you're not in a box. And I've got a really good episode coming out in a couple of weeks with a NHS GP. And we go into, like, all the different side effects and stuff like that. We really, really get into it. But people are resistant to it, right?
While you mentioned GPs, perhaps I'm digressing, but something I would say, and I do say to my boys, as I call them, not very professional, but if you go into your GP, write it all down before you go. Because you'll get in there and you'll be an absolute mess.
Yeah.
You know, as you say, and you just won't be able to verbalise how you're feeling. So write it down before you get in there. You know, explain how you're feeling. Because there's lots of different types of antidepressants. Some are for anxiety, some are for, you know, your mood. So it is, you need a lot of information. It's not sort of carte blanche, I've got depression or anxiety and it's one tablet. So I would suggest you write it down before you go in there. And of course, GPs, they've got 10 minutes to see you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so there's lots of
lots of factors, reasons. Isn't it? Yeah.
It's another huge one I've seen also, is anxiety and panic attacks.
Yeah.
And I think COVID has heightened that.
Yeah, definitely.
People get anxious for all sorts of reasons and I think we were all anxious in the beginning. We didn't even in the pandemic and we didn't know.
Yeah.
But It's very, very difficult, and of course we've really struggled because we haven't had face-to-face meetings with people. We've done so much over the phone, or you know, there hasn't been counselling.
Yeah.
I know people say to me repeatedly, it's no point in having counselling over Zoom. You can't connect with the person.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Yeah, and I think if you're going for, like, I was lucky enough to be able to go private for my counselling, I still do, but if you go via the NHS, it's, you know, you're looking at an 18-month wait
huge,
or something.
Yeah,
it's tricky.
Yeah.
So what do you refer to? Like, what happens? So someone comes to you and you have open them up and decide between the two of you that they should probably go and see a GP.
Yeah, GP's the first port of call.
Do you refer them, or do they have to
make
the appointment?
They have to go themselves.
Right.
Sometimes I've had to write the letter for them, and once I've actually taken the person with me.
Wow.
Because I knew they wouldn't go.
Yeah.
I knew they wouldn't go. Because it's huge, it's frightening, isn't it? Like,
it's scary,
yeah.
It is scary, yeah.
You know, so I have done referrals. As I said, I have taken individuals to the doctors because I know they wouldn't go.
Yeah. Do you find that people come with like other things? So they come with like physical stuff, and as you dig into the physical stuff, then it's not really that important, or it's you know, like a reason to get in your office.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or they will have physical symptoms or ailments, and then when you get chatting, it's all down to something that's happened in the backstory.
Yeah. That's not talked about enough, actually, is the physical of, like, depression and anxiety and how that can affect people physically. There's all sorts of stuff that can happen, isn't there? Like, you know, like diarrhea and stuff with your bowels and headaches.
Neck pain, joint pain,
headaches. Yeah, it can really manifest in different ways.
I always think as well, with exercise, when I least want to do it, that's when I need it most.
Yeah.
And you think, oh God, I can't be bothered today. I don't want to get out of bed, you know. Don't want to brush my teeth even. And thinking, right, have a word with yourself now. Obviously, if you're really, really struggling, obviously it's really difficult. But have a word with yourself now and meet yourself, because they say it's only 20 minutes and your serotonin gets released, doesn't
it? Right. Yeah.
So I think, all right, you do 20 minutes. And the worst, you know, is the going through the gym door, getting out. Once you've done it, it's absolutely fine.
Yeah, it's a lot about changing your state, isn't it? You know, and that can be for a walk or a sleep or a run or a gym session. But then you have to get to a point where you have that self-awareness that you know. Because there was a time when I didn't know anything about changing my state, and if you'd have said to me, go for a run, I'd have said, I'm trying really hard here just to be alive.
Absolutely.
There's no chance I'm going to go
for
a run.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be near a busy road.
Yeah.
I don't want to be near a busy road right now.
But
you have to kind of, you have to make that leap, don't you? You have to get to that place where you can kind of manage things.
I remember a friend of mine, and he had really bad clinical depression. And he used to say that he used to get up in the morning and he used to sit on the settee. And his wife would still be, when he'd come in at 4 o'clock, and his wife would say, "You didn't," and he'd still be there in his pyjamas with his dog on his lap.
Yeah.
Just sitting there.
Yeah. So these, just back to your work, Chris, but these, so when these people go to the GP, and then is it normal that they're off work for a little while? And
it
then
all
they
depends
come back?
Because I've had conversations with people, and they're saying, "I'd rather be in work."
Yeah,
so providing
they're
safe to do their job, obviously people have got to be able to concentrate within a very, very safety conscious environment. As long as they are aware and conscious and of the dangers, I would value. I think work is amazing because again, I've had conversations with people who've been furloughed or working from home. It's really isolating.
Yeah.
You know, so it gives you a reason to get up in the mornings. And I've, a couple of conversations I've had with people who been taking annual leave because they're too anxious to come to work. And I say, well, let's flip that around a little bit. What if you come to work, and if you still feel like that in half an hour, you can go home? And they just say that's the best medicine was to actually physically come into work, even though they were dreading it, and they were, you know, they were anxious, and But actually, and I, you know, coming into work and making that step was better than them sitting in the house and feeling like shit all day.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You know, watching whatever Loose Women or
And worrying that you haven't made it to work and you're letting people down and your boss is getting pissed off and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. It's such small targets.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for structure and routine, and when it's hard to, when you can't mentally impose discipline on yourself, sometimes work can do that. It can give you a reason to get out of
bed. I think the issue is, what job are you doing? You know, obviously if you're a train driver, I wouldn't want you in work if you're driving a train. But if you were worked in a shop and you were out seeing people, and you know, it can boost you. But as I said, it all really is, you know, what type of job you're doing and what support you. And the other thing I find as well is, you might not want to go to work because you've got depression. But you don't say you've got depression because you don't want to feel people to feel, you know, differently about you. So you say you're off with diarrhea and vomiting, or you've got a cold. Or so lots of people don't get found out because they're masking their illnesses under something else.
Yeah, masking their mental illness with a physical illness.
So they wouldn't admit, so they wouldn't admit they're depressed.
No, yeah, I've never thought about that, because that's, you know, if you say I can't come to work because I've got diarrhoea, well, no one's going to ask you about that when you get back, are they?
No, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I do think it is difficult for people, though, men and women, to actually acknowledge if a colleague's got a mental health problem. You know, so if you came to see me and said, you know, you were struggling mentally, I might not be okay with it. I might be, you know, find it very, very difficult. You know, because somebody said to me once, I don't want people to think differently about me.
Yeah.
So even though you're still the same person, there's that, you know, sort of, will people think differently me?
Yeah, yeah, that's huge. And will it affect, like in the workplace, people tend to think, you know, will it affect how people see I can do my job?
Yeah.
Or, you know, that sort of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't want to think, you know, I mean, you're not going to get sacked for having depression, but people do think that they might be pushed to one side, or you know, miss out on the next, when the promotions come out, right, and they interview it, are you going to miss out because of depression?
Absolutely. And I think the other issue is, if you haven't had any form of mental health problem, it is very difficult to take on board how that person's feeling, because I've had it said to me, you know, I will remember one day I confided in a colleague that I was depressed, and my boss turned around and said, what's she got to be depressed about? That's not helpful, is it?
Yeah, that's terrible.
You know, and
really,
at the time, I was really, really struggling to go to work.
Because that's something that, when people talk about depression and they think there's got to be a reason, so either a traumatic episode or, you know, sometimes people think, if you've got everything going for you, like just because you've got a nice job, or just because you've got a nice car, or just because you've got a husband and all that sort of stuff.
You know,
depression doesn't give a fuck, right? Excuse my language, but
absolutely.
That's kind of...
No, but if you haven't ever been depressed, it's very, very difficult for you to take on board what that person's feeling, because you feel like saying, you know, get a grip, pull yourself together, you know, stiff up a lip, man up.
Man up.
Not helpful, is
it? Yeah, definitely.
It's not helpful.
Yeah. And that, I mean, I think that will always be a barrier, because if you haven't experienced something, then it is difficult to, you know, like some people are naturally more compassionate than others, you know. But then the amount of people that have had problems with their mental health, though, I kind of think, like, you know, there will be someone with that level of compassion, because if you've experienced something yourself, I think that makes you it made me a more compassionate person.
Absolutely.
You know, and that it also... weirdly, and there's no like science in this, it's not a thing, I'm not going around diagnosing people, but it is something I've talked about before, you do get a sense for it, you know, you do get to it's a bit like gaydar, you can you know, you can kind of spot other people, and whether it's a vibe, whether it's a tone, whether it's a something, and you do kind of think, oh, I wonder if they're going through or have been through something that I've been through.
And you know, when you ask somebody, are you okay, mean it, not just like, you're right, you know, I'm dismissing it. Ask, and you say, no, are you okay? Because I know you're not. I mean, there are people who have said to me that they haven't even told their wives how they're feeling. And I'm going, why haven't you, well, you know, do you think your wife doesn't know? and then go, probably. And then go, and she's probably worrying because she thinks all sorts of things could be
If you've got a secret, she probably thinks it's something else, right? Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's like, oh, I can't tell my wife or my girlfriend. You know, I don't want them worrying.
Mm. Do your lived experiences make you better at your job, do you think? Does that make
definitely.
You more compassionate? Because you've been through some stuff, right?
Yeah, definitely. But I think an age is great because you've got, you know, what they say, youth is wasted in the young. And I think it's a bit harsh, but to a certain extent, you've got, you know, the university of life behind you. And, you know, I have learned, you know, so much on the way, and, you know, whereas before I would be guilty about, and I had to have counselling for it, and I used to be guilty about everything, and the counsellor said to me, you can be as guilty as you like, but nobody's getting anything out of this.
No,
and I
true.
Thought, yeah, it's a wasted emotion, and probably spent half my life feeling guilty about all manner of things that I'd done and, you know, or hadn't done, and that changed my mindset, because...
Yeah.
I don't. If I start feeling guilty about something, I just stop it.
Mm.
And it's made me. I would say it's made me a lot more positive. You know, and you say don't sweat the small stuff. And the only thing you have to worry about in this life is your health.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, mental or physical. Everything else will be sorted. Everything else will always be sorted.
Yeah, and you got to put yourself in the best possible place to sort it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is difficult. It is really, really difficult. But I think things are getting better.
Yeah. Well, that was my next, you know, subject, really. Like, what do you think, you know, like, we know men in particular don't talk enough. Mm. We know that mental health rates, suicide rates, all these statistics are just going up. And nothing's really changing. You know, like, there's more podcasts,
yeah.
There's more social media posts, there's more hashtags, there's more stuff going on than ever. So what do we need to change? What can we do differently?
Stop being so hard on ourselves, because we, and it's true, it's a conversation I have all the time with the men that come and see me, and I say, right, you're being really hard because whatever reason, you know, I'm not a good enough father, I'm not a good enough workmate, I'm not good enough at my job, I'm not good enough. I said, why are you beating yourself up? I said, because if you wouldn't have this conversation with your best friend and be so harsh on him, we are very, very harsh on ourselves. Very, very harsh. We can be nice to other people and we can be empathetic to other people, but we don't do it to ourselves.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think we should stop beating ourselves up. Everybody out there is trying their best.
Yeah, let some of it go, right?
Yeah.
So self-compassion is is the way to go. Yeah.
And stop, you know, just stop beating yourself up. You're trying
that's
your
a,
best.
That's a societal thing though, right? That's a culture thing. That's like, do you know what I mean? Like, people aren't aware that they're doing it. That's why someone, you know, someone comes to see you and you have to tell them to stop speaking to themselves like that, because they don't know, because it's just the norm.
The negativity,
right?
and as you say, you don't know what, you know, people's backstories are, but we are very, very hard society. And, you know, we've got, you know, life is hard. You know, you've got mortgages to pay. We've come out of pandemic. Children have been struggling. With men, again, I have lots of different stories, relationship problems and custody battles. And another one that's I've had quite a bit to do with is men in the IVF struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So, because the woman gets all the attention and the woman is the sort of the centre of the
medical
thing. But there's a man in the back who's not getting any attention, but he's expected to, you know, to support.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one. I suppose it's the same when you're a dad. Everybody looks after the mother and the baby, but, you know, you very much don't get... you know, the conversations that maybe men should have, and, you know, it's a huge responsibility, isn't it? It's massive.
The role of dad is really, like, it's I don't know, it's almost like it's in the process of changing, because it wasn't that long ago that dads wouldn't be in the delivery room, they'd be at work, and maybe they'd like go from work instead of going to the hospital to see the baby, they'd go to the pub to smoke a cigar and wet the baby's head.
Yeah.
Like you weren't expected to be involved, and then now you're sort of, you are expected to be involved, but at the same time you only get 2 weeks paternity leave.
Yeah, it's not
so
long,
you're supposed to, you know, you're expected to be like this all-consuming loving dad, but society is built for you to just kind of crack on and go back to work, and you, it's a very strange middle ground for a bloke around that time.
It's awful, you know, and it's just the woman gets all the attention, and you know, the poor old dad, as you say, and it's huge, you know, it must be so overwhelming. You know, I think it's, and it's only because of having conversation with men how they do feel.
Definitely,
you know, COVID has affected relationships, and people, you know, who have been estranged from their families, couldn't see their kids, and all these things have come, I think, have come to a head now, because we're coming out of COVID, and we existed, and we did what we had to do to survive COVID, and now people have got to reinvent their lives now again, start all over again.
Yeah, we'll see the real, you know, there's been one awful side effect, obviously the death tolls and stuff like that have been horrendous, you know, and that's awful for the people that that's affected. But then there's now going to be another one, and we're going to see the you know, how it's going to affect us in the non-virus related, not physically, in the future, but
yeah, absolutely. You see people working from home, you know, everybody thought it was great being furloughed originally when the weather was lovely and whatever, but it's been a long hard winter.
Went on a while, didn't it?
Yeah,
went on a while. Yeah,
I volunteered in the food bank, and I had a case the other day, and it really upset me. Somebody couldn't come to the food bank because they had such bad mental health and they were agoraphobic. They couldn't come. So you can imagine now, you've been in the house for whatever months, and all of a sudden society is opening up again, and you're expected to go out, and you've got, you know, mental health problems, and you're agoraphobic, and you're expected to go out again. They'd stopped, that's it, they'd stopped the person's benefit because they had such bad mental health they couldn't go and sign on.
Yeah.
I was thinking, this is awful.
Yeah.
You know, when your life is dependent on you going to this place to sign whatever you have to sign, and they couldn't do it, so they stopped the benefits.
Yeah. I mean, it's mad enough in modern life anyway that there's a need for food banks, like, you know, people have got so much,
but
and some people have
a lot
so
of a lot of people that were coming to the food bank, we call jams, just about managing.
Right, yeah.
So they're not on benefits, they're on minimum wage, and obviously cost of living has gone through the roof. I mean, I my food bill's gone up. I've seen a rise in my cost of my food bill. They've had to feed children, you know, 24/7, so their food bills are going up, and they just, you know, they're living on minimum wage. Lots of people have lost their jobs, and they're not in the benefit system, so they haven't had any money at all. So it's huge.
Yeah, it's a slog, right? You can see why it affects people's
mental
health.
Lots of people are self-employed. You know, so they used to having a good income. Didn't see this coming, did they?
No one did. So between your work and the food bank and, you know, the vaccine rollout and stuff like that, how do you, that's a lot to take on, how do you protect your own mental health? What do you do to kind of navigate that? Because sometimes if you've had a day at work where you've seen loads of people and it's been a bit much, you must come home sometimes and just be like,
I do have bad days. I do have wobbles, and I think I have to, you know, I acknowledge them now. You know, because when you're working with people and you really care, you absorb.
Yeah, very much so.
And I come home and I do worry about people, and I know these people, I've been there a long time. So it does, but, and I do have wobbles and I do have bad days, but they do pass, and it's about, you know, shit happens in life, it's how you deal with it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And having to listen to your body, and as I say, when I least want to exercise, I know I need it the most.
Yeah.
You know, and don't do the self-medicating of 10 packets of biscuits or, you know, a bottle of wine or whatever, because I know it doesn't mean no favours, because the following day it just feels worse.
Yeah.
But it's been a long, long learning curve to get where I am now. And I say, and it's, you know, I'm 53 in September, so I probably wouldn't have dealt with it as well when, if I was 25 or...
Yeah.
You know, now it's just, age has benefited me, and I can acknowledge it's okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
And we can turn around and say, do you know what, I'm actually not having a good day.
Yeah, how can I get, what do I need to get through it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, having those things in place. It all comes down to being proactive, not reactive.
Yeah, true. Yeah. But I say lots of people try and self-medicate, don't they?
And
as I say, it takes a long time to find out what ticks for you.
Yeah, I think as well with like self-medication or distraction or whatever, like a lot of the things we use are so commonplace in society that people don't even know they're doing it.
Absolutely.
So it's particularly stuff like food or, you know, alcohol.
Absolutely.
You know, alcohol's it's a depressive drug.
Oh, gosh, it's awful.
And it, you know, because it's legal, no one cares about it. But, you know, that's like the worst thing you can do.
Oh, gosh. I'd have days where I'd had a hard night the night before. And obviously, in my role, got to be very, very mindful, safe limits and everything. And I'd be maudlin and crying, and late say to me, my husband, he'd go, Chris, you know you drank too much last night, pull yourself together. And you're just like, I had no sympathy at all, because you brought it on yourself. And it's like, oh, I'm this and that, oh, crying. And it's like, well, you shouldn't have drunk all that last night.
Yeah.
And that's why you're feeling like you do.
Because it's the norm, isn't it? The whole world goes out on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
So it's easy to kind of get involved in that. But,
yeah.
So a lot of people are self-medicating and they don't even know that they're doing it. They just think that they're doing all the stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's complicated. It's hard being a human being.
It is. But it's you just got to be, don't go, you know, what would you tell your best friend? That's what I say. Is it, what would you tell your best friend?
That's it.
And you've got to listen to your body. Some days you can't go 100 miles an hour all the time.
Mm.
Whereas before, I would be guilty if I didn't go to the gym.
That stuff's huge.
Yeah.
So the best advice I was ever given, and that was like, find your percentage that you can live life at and just go at that. So if I go 100% at everything for too long, then I'll crash.
Of course you will,
80%, 75%, 80%. I can sit at that for a long, long time and life's pretty good. If it dips below that, I don't get anything done. I don't earn any money. I don't achieve anything if I go like too flat out. But if I can just balance everything to about 75%, 80%, and just coast along at that, things work pretty well. And different people will have, some people can operate 110%, you know, and other people it's going to be like 50, but everyone's different. But I suppose that's where your self-compassion comes in again, Chris.
I think so, absolutely. And we're all different, you know. You've got to walk a mile in a man's shoes, and what somebody can cope with, somebody else might not be able to cope with.
And I really want to, it's easy to talk about mental health and then just to like kind of go down this rabbit hole of how tough things can be, and I really want to try and finish on a high. So going back to your work, is it like, it must be pretty cool when people come to you and you're like scraping them off the floor into your car to go to the GP, and then they come back in and you bump into them or something like that down the line, and they're together, right?
That's wonderful. I went to see I bumped into somebody last week, and he's had a really, really difficult couple of years, and out of his control. None of it was any of his making. And I said, how are things with you? And he goes, Chris, I've never ever been as good as this.
Wow.
Best ever. And it's like, I said, do you know what, you have absolutely made my day, you made my week, you made my and you know, you probably feel like you're never going to get out of it, and you're always going to be, but you will get better.
You know? And you can be better, like a lot better. And I think, you know, we talk about, you know, okay, it's okay to not be okay, and that's completely fine, but you know, you can be more than okay.
Absolutely.
A lot more. And you know, you can. You can. That's it.
Absolutely.
There's no more to say, right? You can.
Absolutely.
Oh, super. Well, that feels like a great note, Chris. Chris, thank you very much. I've loved this. I wanted to do this for a long time, so it's great to get your insight.
Oh, I love you, Tom.
Let's go and have a cup of tea.
Get the kettle on. Oh, God. I got a lot out of that, I think.
Good.
Thank you for listening from the Proper Mental Podcast. Please like and subscribe.
Plus 5 stars.